Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Author and speaker, Ayanla Van Zant said, "In my mind, marriage is a spiritual partnership and union in which we willingly give and receive love, create and share intimacy, and open ourselves to be available and accessible to another human being in order to heal, learn, and grow." We all know well the passion of young love, the unequaled joy and promise of the life to come with the person of our dreams. 15 years, two kids, and a mortgage, and seeing the same naked body each and every day, day after day, can take a toll on the spark of passion that was once so easily ignited. Gone are the days of quickies in the morning and long nights of pillow talk where life plans were painted on the canvases of our minds. Instead, we find ourselves living lives more as roommates, slogging through the routines of our chosen lives than as best friends with passion. The question is, what else is there? Once the relationship matures and hits the grind of daily life, is there a place and a path to find true contentment of a life shared? Can we rekindle the flame of passion and find a deeper intimacy that grows better with age like fine wine? Or is all that just romantic nonsense? Joining me today to discuss the psychology of sexuality and intimacy are local therapists Rebecca Love and Chris Reynolds. Both are licensed professional counselors who specialize in marital therapy and focus on sexual health. Before we get started on today's topic, I want to remind our listeners of the listeners of Line One that Dr. Woodard will continue to host Line One, Your Health Connection, 3 weeks a month, and will cover a variety of health topics that are relevant to us all. I will continue as a monthly host of Line One and will typically be airing the last Monday of each month. The focus of my efforts will be on bringing you relevant and helpful information about mental health and wellness. I also want to encourage people to browse all of Dr. Woodard's previous shows on the website. It can be found by going to alaskapublicmedia.org and clicking on Line One. It really is a great resource of information. And if you have a medical concern or an issue, I bet you Dr. Woodard has done a show on it before. Be sure to check out the links on our webpage for today's show. We put together a lot of resource information on today's topic. Finally, if you have any questions for today's guests or comments about our topic, you can reach us in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. The last way to reach us is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. I want to thank both of you for coming on the show. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Prentice.
So there's no pressure here, guys. You have 1 hour to help all our listeners find the key to great sex and deep intimacy. I think we can maybe take care of that today. I guess before we get going, I'd like to have each of you give me a little bit of background, and I guess we can start with you, Rebecca, and I apologize for bringing up the name, but I couldn't pass it up. Rebecca Love. I was looking for guests, and somebody said, "How about Rebecca Love?" And I said, "How about that? That's perfect for what I'm doing." And I'm sure you get that all the time. But
I do. It's memorable and an excellent name to have. Good for my profession. I'm a counselor in town. I'm in private practice. I started out actually working in OBGYN for a couple of years. So my specialty is around sexual health, sexual pain issues, women's sexuality, and seeing couples.
All right. Chris?
Beck and I were just talking about this off air, and I actually think of myself more as a generalist. I really enjoy seeing couples and individuals for a wide variety of reasons. But one of the most productive areas, clinical areas that I work in is sexuality, so it's a particular favorite of mine.
Okay. You guys both work as marital therapists and then with a focus, is it focus on intimacy and sexuality or is that what people come to you for primarily or is it just regular run of the mill?
I would say so for me, yes.
Mm-hmm. For me, people come in, with a variety of presenting problems and, it's interesting. Early in my career, I would have cases that I would think of as sex therapy cases and other cases that I thought of as non-sex therapy cases. But the longer I did this work, the more the question of how is your sex life started integrating itself in a fluid way into really all of my practice. So it's a little artificial to separate it at this point.
Well, it seems like marital therapy and, the quest for intimacy and sexuality, if you need assistance with that, like marital therapy is the place to start. But it's all, as we'll find out today, it's all so intertwined and mixed up with each other. Intimacy, sexuality, the stuff we bring to the table from our childhood. So we'll get into all that. All right. So for the purposes of this show and this discussion today, let's define intimacy. If you guys could talk a little bit of what is intimacy, because there's lots of different ideas out there.
I think, you know, as I thought about that question, I thought it's not an easy definition necessarily, but I think it's a turning towards a connection, you know, a feeling that you're vulnerable and safe there with other. I think it is not mechanics and pressure-based and, you know, it is not... It's almost a spiritual thing, maybe a spiritual sense of connection with another person.
Yeah, I really like that description of intimacy, and I think it can be helpful to think of that dynamic can manifest in lots of different ways. There's sexual intimacy, obviously, but we can also be intimate in an emotional way. There's intimacy that comes from just a shared life together, 20 years together, even if neither of those first two were there. We could keep going on and on. There's lots of different elements to holding oneself in a very close and vulnerable space with another person through time.
Intimacy is about closeness. It's about trust. It's about giving. I guess the way I describe it to clients is you give your heart to somebody else and you say, here, take care of that, and they give it back to you, and that's intimacy, is caring for that other person's heart as well as you would your own. All right. Sexuality is the other thing we're going to talk about. I know they're all going to overlap, but sexuality, for definition of our program today, Chris?
Boy, for me, that is a very wide concept, and oftentimes when people talk about sexuality, they think about you know, penises, vaginas, and sexual parts and sexual acts. But for me, it's much larger than that, and it has to do with everything from gender to you know, negotiating platonic relationships and our sexuality as individuals in platonic relationships. It has to do with the biology of our bodies and reproduction. So it's really it encompasses all of those aspects of sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I think that it's, I think I've heard you say before, Chris, it's kind of a pillar of personality, of one of five, of, you know, something that maybe we don't talk about all the time or we're not overt about with everyone in our lives, but it's always there. And always throughout the lifespan, important in different ways.
All right. I think of, you know, intimacy and sexuality, if it's done right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like if it's done right in a romantic relationship, it can really be the sort of one and the same thing. Okay.
I agree with that. I think that it doesn't always have to be one and the same thing, but of course, that's a vehicle that many people use, sexuality, to express and achieve intimacy, but I think many would argue that that sexuality doesn't have to play out in that context, and that would be a valid expression of sexuality.
Gotcha. All right. So the traditional relationship model, I think. We're talking about romantic intimacy here. There's also friend intimacy, social intimacy, the intimacy between a parent and a child. There's all sorts of different types of intimacy. So we're going to talk about the connection of sexuality and intimacy in the romantic relationship. And I want to sort of make it clear that we're not talking about specifically marriage. That was one of the things that I said in the intro. The quote had marriage in it. But it really is about long-term committed relationships that are the traditional monogamous long-term committed relationship. All right, so chemistry, that's the thing that everybody associates with love, right? What the heck is chemistry? You can't put your finger on it. You can't measure it. Why are we attracted to certain people? And, you know, they call them soulmates. You feel completed, all that stuff. What is chemistry?
Yeah, I think that's a really tricky question that has to do with a lot of things. I think that as people talk about it, they feel drawn towards someone or they notice them out of a room of all kinds of people. I don't think that's the only way to feel chemistry. You know, some of it is probably more, as we were just talking about, more biochemical than we acknowledge or would maybe even like to realize. I think when people talk about it at the beginning of a relationship, it's dopamine rushing through your brain, making you feel great around that person and wanting to just know more and more and more about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the question of why do we click with some people and not click with others? And I agree with Becca, there's a lot of different sort of layers to this, but you know, maybe the psychosocial, one of the psychosocial layers is, you know, given my history and who I am and my lessons in childhood, I do a certain dance of intimacy. And when somebody else is doing the reciprocal or a similar dance, then that just fits, you know, it just flows. And we don't like to think of it, we don't like to say that that's why we clicked with our partners. We like to think it's something a little deeper than that. But, you know, on a psychosocial level, that really makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. There's also, you know, pheromone levels. There's a really interesting study. They put different guys in different white T-shirts, had them sleep in the shirt, had them put that shirt in a Ziploc bag, then had a bunch of women rate their attractiveness, how attracted they were to the smells in the bag. So here's the interesting part. The men that were the most attractive by pheromones to the women were the ones whose DNA was a particular match for the woman's DNA, such that if they got together, they would produce children with high immunity.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So chemistry may be, I mean, you said biochemical, meaning the hormones that are released, but, I guess at a deeper level, what is it that, why does one person trigger that reaction and other ones don't? And maybe it has to do with pheromones, mm-hmm. secretions, and perhaps what we brought with us from our own families of origin as far as our ideas. I mean, how that, you said the dance. Mm-hmm. So how our script or how our story fits up with theirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a complicated question, and the reality is we don't have all the answers, but these are some of the clues that we've come up with.
What do you tell the teenagers who say they found their soulmate?
We validate it, because that's what we do as counselors. We validate their emotions and acknowledge them as very strong, and we listen and see what changes there. And maybe they did,
you know? That was a little sidetrack from my own mm-hmm. practice, because I get that all the time. Oh, I'm going to get married and have babies. I say, you're 15. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. How's that? But I was 15 once, and I think I had like 4 fiancés before I got out of high school. Uh-huh. Like, not really, but mm-hmm. in my mind.
Right.
Yeah, so that's intimacy, right? But they're just making the mistake that this is all of intimacy as opposed to this is one kind of intimacy, 15-year-old intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think of that as practice mm-hmm. intimacy. Mm-hmm. And it can get a little bit carried away sometimes. The breakdown of intimacy, the loss of sexuality, seem to be really the common themes in my work, in our work. And they present a challenge to all of us in our lives, I think, it's to some degree or another. You know, personally, I think none of us get through it without being touched by difficulties there. Is there a stage or a point in a relationship? I mean, is there a rule book that says, okay, at this year or at this stage, once you have kids, you're going to experience these sorts of intimacy challenges? But is there a typical time when people start to say, is this what it is?
Well, I think the research that I know supports two things. One, John Gottman, who does a ton of really well-researched work on love and sex and intimacy, talks about the least happy couples statistically are couples who have just had a baby. The most happy couples statistically are ones who have had kids, but they're out of the house. And so it's tricky. It makes people think, oh, great, I'm going to be miserable for the next 20 years. Not so, but that's some of of his work. But what we also know about hormones is that about 18 months into a relationship, you start seeing a pretty significant shift from those dopamine highs to more of an oxytocin bonding companionate nature.
Well, we know that there are typical stages that couples' relationships go through. Not every couple follows these stages the same way, but we know that it starts with enmeshment or this honeymoon period. And for some couples, that lasts a few weeks, and for some couples, that lasts a few years. But eventually, there's an urge to move out of this that stage where you really mush yourself together with the other person. At some point, there's an urge to reestablish more individuality because the balance becomes threatening. And we call that individuation. And that stage, when one person says, basically in the union, I need more space here, that can be a real threatening moment. Oftentimes we see intimacy problems coming up at that point.
Okay. I want to remind folks who might be tuning in late that my guests today are Anchorage therapist Rebecca Love and Chris Reynolds. We're discussing the psychology of intimacy and sexuality. I want to take this opportunity to remind listeners you can reach us with your questions or comments in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. And as always, you got to spell that all out. All right. So intimacy. Can you go back to what you were saying just a second ago? I wanted to jump on something that you said. You were talking about intimacy and...
The first stage being enmeshment or that honeymoon phase. And then...
Okay. So that's what it was. Thanks for reminding me. Sure. So that separation where that person individuates from their partner and says, hey, this union, this collective us is no longer the primary thing we have, or it is the primary thing, but I also have me. Mm-hmm. And so that's a time when people begin to experience difficulties with intimacy and sexuality. How's that challenge addressed?
Well, that's a common time when couples experience problems with intimacy, but depending on who you are and what your buttons are, your problems with intimacy may have come up during the enmeshment phase, maybe. Mm-hmm. But most of them come up when there's this individuation process coming up. And most people, you know, we don't sit down with our spouses and say, you know, I think I'm about to individuate from you, and here's what it's going to look like, and here's my needs, and what are your needs? It all just happens organically, you know? Mm-hmm. We just flow into it, and oftentimes we have insight about it after the fact. So... you know, it may look like less of a desire to have sex. Sex is a very intimate, primal joining, and if what one's system is asking for is more individual space, then that person may feel a need to or a desire to masturbate more and to join in sexual relationship with their partner less. So it can take a lot of different forms.
Isn't it really unlikely to match up with somebody that has exactly the same sexual appetites as you do?
It never happens, ever.
Okay, so yeah. That would be infrequent. Never.
We would say there's always a discrepancy in desire. You know, sometimes I think the wider that gap, maybe the trickier it is. But, you know, no one comes into our office and says we want exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about sexuality and how at the beginning of that relationship in the enmeshment phase, everybody's feeling really sexual. And then we sort of go back and find our normal levels of sexuality and what mm-hmm. we're comfortable with mm-hmm. and what we're, you know, as far as experimentation or frequency or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is. And that might be a time when it's challenging.
Yeah, and, you know, even if two people are very well matched up in terms of their frequency, there's always going to be particular times of the month or times of the year or maybe an evening or two where one person is hot to trot and the other is not. So, you know, there's desire discrepancy is always a part of marriage.
Yeah, and I think it's how do you negotiate that in a way that is not threatening to self that means it can be successful.
I think of maintaining intimacy in a relationship. I think of it kind of like physical health or car care, and that regular attention and maintenance will keep big problems at bay. Do you guys kind of see relationships as the same way? And when should people really start working on this stuff?
I would say absolutely. I think that, you know, my clients would say I'm kind of preachy about date night and time, really, where they're turning towards each other and a bit away from everything else in life, whether that's kids, whether that's in-laws, whether that's work or whatever. I do think it can be really tough for people to do that. I think a lot of families up here in particular don't have a lot of extended family support, maybe because of military or whatever. But I find that's a really common challenge. I rarely have people come in saying, we have absolutely regular date night and spend 10 minutes a night looking each other in the eye and talking, and we have all these problems. You know, I'm not saying it's an insurance policy against that, but often it's, well, we're on our tablets or our phones, or we're busy with the kids, and then we crash into bed, you know, turn towards each other and give each other the kind of worst version of ourselves, the most tired, the least intentional.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And, you know, it's like every other part of life, you get out of it what you put into it, whether it's your kids or your career or your intimate relationship. And this is why this gets back to the statistic that Becca mentioned a few minutes ago. This is one of the ways that we make sense out of that statistic, is that when our kids are real young, they just take so much time and energy and investment. Oftentimes, there just isn't a whole lot left over for the couple's relationship, which is why at that stage in the marriage, it's often the experience of it is often as the least satisfying time in not in the family unit, but in mm-hmm. the couple unit.
Oh, that's a good distinction, because the family may be quite functional and healthy and you're really enjoying it, but it's the intimacy and the sexuality that's mm-hmm. that really takes each partner being really mindful and present mm-hmm. about that relationship.
I think that's really about roles too. For me, roles are really important, and in the sense that I think if you're in your mom role or in your dad role or in your whatever, your work role, you're not really connected with your sexual self, probably, and with that part that meshes really well with your partner. You might be great at co-parenting together, but if you're not, I guess, inviting yourselves and each other to be in those roles, I think it's really easy to get away from them. You know, I think, and hopefully couples check in about that. You know, I'm feeling kind of distant, or gosh, we haven't connected in a while. So I think roles... we're good at, you know, paying attention to, okay, what is my role right now? And that's one that I think gets squished a lot.
And this is fascinating, isn't it, Becca, that when that kind of challenge happens, then what Becca and I keep our eyes on is, now what are you doing with that as a couple? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge. That's what's happening right now. So what are you as a couple doing with that? Is that manifesting in your relationship in a way that results in the two of you getting further apart? Or do you use that conflict to solidify the base of the marriage so that you know that your partner's got your back, especially when the chips are down? Mm-hmm.
The two of you drifting further apart, I mean, I think that's a great way to look at it. And it happens so slowly mm-hmm. and so, like, in such small amounts over time that then you wake up one day and you say, who are you? And why are we here?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's also when you're most vulnerable to external things like, whatever, the internet, Craigslist, Facebook friends getting in touch with you, and anybody who's connecting sexually. I mean, I think that's when you're particularly vulnerable to that. I feel really protective, I think, of couples in society today, because I think that nobody's fighting for the couple except for those two. You know, I think there's a lot of pressures from work or whatever that interfere with that. And I think you have to be really mindful in order to not succumb to that.
It seems like it's a really hard thing to do intimacy over time well.
Yeah. Not impossible, right?
Agreed. Yeah.
It's actually not impossible, but you had good points that the time before marriage and the time after, or before children and after children leave, are the mm-hmm. best times for the couple. All that stuff in the middle is really where we, I think, bring ourselves closer together, or we get driven, mm-hmm. as you said, that wedge in between us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key to keeping it close.
Esther Perel wrote a great book about that, and the, I just love the title. It's called Mating in Captivity.
Mating in Captivity. Is that a good resource that we should add to our show? Or?
Yeah, I think it is.
Oh, absolutely. I think that book is great.
I like the title.
Yeah.
We do have some good resources. I think Rebecca's touched on a couple of exercises for building intimacy. We do have on the website some couples exercises for building intimacy, 10 ways to create strong intimate relationships. So there's some good resources there that you can look at to try things at home if you're interested in this subject. I read something recently said the best time to work on your marriage is before you have one. Self-awareness seems to be like key to having a healthy relationship. Unfortunately, most people don't do all that work because life is sort of an evolving thing, and you know, our growth goes throughout our lifespan. But being healthy when you enter a marriage seems like it would be an important thing. Is there an advantage to that? I mean, obviously there is, but specifically towards relationship health?
Sure. I think, you know, doing our own work before we become intimately attached allows us to not have a needs-based union. If I haven't done my work as an individual, and so I have leftover needs that are unaccommodated for, then I need you to do that, or I'm not okay. And so if I've done my work before we enter into a union, now I can really allow you to be who you are. I don't have to pressure you to fill a certain need for me, and that's one of the advantages. But the reality is, this is lifelong work, and mm-hmm. we enter into intimacy when we enter into intimacy. it's always only going to be partway done.
Yeah, if we wait until the right time and the right place, it'll never happen.
Yeah.
I would have to say I've seen an increase in premarital counseling couples coming into my office, which I just absolutely love. I think that maybe certain religious backgrounds have known that there's a need for that, and some people have done that and some haven't. I wouldn't call them all perfect, but I think just as important as kind of bringing yourself well and healthy and knowing your recipe for happiness mostly before you kind of pair up with someone, it's really nice to have some of those big conversations out of the way and to create good communication before, you know, you're legally in it. You've got a complicated...
If somebody... That's a question that I hadn't thought of, but if somebody's going to go to premarital counseling, if they're going to engage in that, what kind of things should they be addressing or talking about in that early stage to set it up for health in the future?
You know, I mean... What comes to mind first is the things that I think it's really dangerous not to talk about ahead of time. Chris, I don't know if you have some input here, but, you know, if you get couples who one really wants kids, one doesn't, and they're married and reproductive age comes along, you know, that is tough. I mean, it is tough to have both people's needs individually met with that big of a discrepancy. So I would recommend talking about kids. I'd talk, you know, what do people fight about the most? Kids, sex, money, and religion, probably
religion.
In-laws is in there too. You know, so I think it's just less maybe about the content, but more about having the conversations of, okay, I might feel this way about something. How do you feel? And making space to have a dialogue? I don't...
Yeah, I think we do similar work in premarital therapy. And, you know, we try to bring out as much content as we can. But the reality is the conflict... that's going to exist there in 5 years, that's going to be a crisis. It's just not there mm-hmm. at the time of premarital counseling. So we bring the content out to the degree that it's there, you know, sex, finances, kids, all that. But really what we focus on in the room is what is your strategies for engaging in conflict? That you can nail down now.
Mm-hmm.
When the chips are down, what's your commitment to your partner and what's your commitment to yourself about what you're going to do, what strategy you're going to take? And that can determine a course of whether they come closer together in conflict or get further apart.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We are at the 30-minute break, so I'm going to go ahead and take our little break here. If you are listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSK Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. Or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. or you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we will continue our conversation with our guests, Rebecca Love and Chris Reynolds. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. In case you're just joining us, I have in studio Rebecca Love and Chris Reynolds. Both are licensed professional counselors and work in sexual issues with couples. Today, we are discussing the psychology of intimacy and sexuality. I need to take a second to remind listeners that Dr. Woodard will continue to bring you relevant health information on Line One, your health connection, 3 Mondays every month. And I will continue to sit in as host for a show focused on mental health 1 week a month. You can email questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. Call locally at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evening, you will be hearing a taped recording. All right, so before the break, we were talking about intimacy and sexuality and some of the things that stand in the way or some of the things you can do to improve it. What are the barriers? I mean, you hear a lot about barriers to intimacy or threats to intimacy, because at some point, I assume most relationships start as a fairly intimate relationship and then sort of evolve away from that. But what are some of the common threats to intimacy or the barriers to intimacy for couples? Who wants to tackle that one first?
There's a lot of them there.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of barriers to intimacy that are easy to see, like affairs and a pornography for some people becomes a substitute for couples' intimacy. But for me, it starts way before that. And frankly, I don't think that we're a very sexually sophisticated society. Sexuality is a very, very complicated aspect of our personalities. And we just don't do a good job of teaching our kids how to care for and nurture this part of who they are. And so for the most part, they're left to figure it out on their own. You know, we're a culture that is inundated with eroticism. But that is a tiny sliver of what sexuality is. And so if we think of sexuality in very broad terms, we just sort of let kids figure it out on their own. So, of course, as adults, we make all kinds of mistakes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing you bring up, because we might go with another show on the access that kids have to sexual images and what that does to create their sexuality. We'll continue that question a little bit, but we got a call. Jeff, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I heard you talk about couples' long-term relationships and how it changes, but inherent and explicitly in all your examples, you talk about couples who are together a long time, who either have children or children left the house. What about couples who are together for decades and never have any children?
That's
a
great question.
Is there a dynamic there that changes somehow, or that's unique?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have a whole lot of insight about that, Becca.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I appreciate that, because I think it does help kind of create a more whole view of the relationships we're talking about. It would be really interesting, actually, to have someone in that situation give us their perspective on that. I think that probably it goes through the same ebbs and flows and closeness and distance for other reasons. But there may not be perhaps some of the physiological exhaustion or, you know, things like that from having, let's say, lack of sleep from a newborn. But, you know, I mean, people go through medical changes. They go through, you know, there's menopause. There's all kinds of different developmental stages that people go through that I think might offer some of the same challenges as adding people into your home.
I suspect the number of changes one goes through, life stages, probably is not really limited to any unique number. I think, as we get to live longer and longer, I think other things, dynamics change. One of the things that I notice is that as I'm getting older and as my wife and I are both getting older, our personal preferences have more importance than they used to. We're each of us a little less likely to just sort of put up with stuff that we don't particularly care for but would have tolerated, 10 or 15 years ago simply for the sake of a social acceptance, perhaps. But that also goes on between people, and that's what, the thought that came to mind why I made the call, because it's your premise has always been that the couple is, or heterosexual, well, any couple, is having children, that there are going to be children come and in the house, and if the relationship lasts long enough, the children move away. But I've been married almost 35 years. We don't have any children.
Yeah, Jeff, I appreciate your calling in and...
I'll get back to listening.
Thank you. But I was going to say, I appreciate your calling in and representing that group of intimacy. And with regards, with the exception of the things that I think we've said that are specifically pertaining to children, I think most of what we've said would apply to folks without children. But Jeff's story reminds me that there is this dynamic that sometimes happens, and I think it does happen more often with people without kids, where two people get along so well and just move through life really as best friends. And sometimes this particular attachment style, sometimes they have trouble with sexual intimacy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think of it as, these two are just tight, like a brother and a sister, and that's not really who you want to get in bed with. That's a deep intimacy and a meaningful intimacy, and these people are very well bonded, but oftentimes the sexual piece is a hurdle for them.
And I think, Jeff, you bring up a great point, because I think couples without children do struggle with intimacy as well, and I think it's a different set of... Some of the challenges are different, but there's still stressors and threats and barriers to intimacy. But in some ways, I think it may be even more of a challenge for couples without children to stay together, because during that time of difficulty, they may have less to stay together for. I think my mom, who's a marital therapist, said that the reason that her and my father stayed married is because neither one of them gave up on the other one at the same time. They both didn't give up at the same time, and that's... because at some point in their lives, they gave up on each other at some point or another. All right, we have another call, Rebecca, about challenge of disease in marriage. What do you have, Rebecca?
Hi. My husband and I are very, very close. We've been married probably 11 years. A year after our marriage, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Mm. And the crazy, weird thing is I was very, very active. I mean, I found out I had my first symptoms when we were out camping in Seward, my big hiking boots and all that. So it really changed our lives. And besides that, I also was diagnosed with fibromyalgia and then lupus. Mm-hmm. And as sad as all that sounds, we've done great. I mean... Mm-hmm. I retired when I was 25, and my job's been to take care of myself. And it's been my husband and I and our dogs, and that has all been very, very wonderful. Mm. But the challenges in the intimacy are just so big, just based on symptoms and you know, my husband works really hard and comes home and sees that not much has been done because I can't work as an active housewife necessarily. And, you know, it's just more work for him, and he handles it all great, but it definitely has affected our intimacy.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It sounds, I love that you called in, and I'm glad to hear of the message of resilience in there, you know. My goodness, I think it's, I can see why intimacy and sexuality take a little bit of a hit there, especially because, you know, when we talk about this, we're talking about being in our bodies. And for women in particular, at least in my opinion, it seems that when I see women, it's often a lot of their sexual interest and desire and all of that comes from their relationship with their bodies. Not necessarily how it looks, often that, but also, you know, is it doing what you want it to do? Is it functioning how you want? And I think that in sometimes, and correct me if I'm not speaking for you, but sometimes with fibromyalgia or lupus or MS, it can feel like sort of a betrayal by your body.
Absolutely.
So, please go ahead.
I was just going to say I've always been a very intimate person, but I've definitely felt that change.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of it is because I love my husband and I just want to give him as much love as I can.
Mm-hmm.
But my body, just as you said, my body is like, oh, really, right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not really going to feel good.
Right.
You know, there are times where I've found ways to, you know, different mind games and all that, where I actually have to kind of separate myself from my body so that I don't have to think about numb and pain and any of that.
Right.
And I can, and really, that's probably the one of the main ways I can be intimate, is I have to separate.
Right. That's interesting because, you know, we talk about dissociating. I think, Prentice, you were talking about barriers to intimacy, and one of the things that comes up for me is kind of no matter where that's coming from, addiction or mental illness or medical issues, it's sort of that dissociation from oneself and one's body that is problematic. And yet it sounds like for you in this situation, it may be sort of adaptive. I think that often challenges in our bodies, and I know we probably need to move on, but I think whether, again, it's menopause, it's cancer, it's chemo, it's you know, erectile issues, whatever, I think that it often can sort of be very difficult at the beginning because it challenges the intimacy and sexuality perhaps that you had in your head or that culture has programmed or that you're used to. And I think it can be a really positive way to get more into your senses, into your whole body, into less of a goal-oriented, performance-oriented view of sex, which I would argue is really helpful for sex across the lifespan.
Yeah, Rebecca, I think your story is a...
Go ahead.
I think your story is a wonderful example of, as Rebecca says, resiliency and adaptation. It sounds like you have a really wonderful, solid marriage. And one thing I would suggest... Well, let me take a step back a bit. I really appreciate that we're using the word intimacy here and not... talking about sexual behaviors. And my guess is what each of you want out of intimacy can be gained through a wide range of behaviors that are still available to you. So part of this is sometimes about just opening up the sexual repertoire. And, you know, you made a comment that you you sometimes have sex from a very generous place where you sort of push through the pain or disassociate. And Rebecca, I think that comes from a very admirable place in you. And I also want to just caution that we want to make sure that we're never engaging in a sexual way when our bodies don't want us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That can lead down a path of physical self-protection that our bodies will do, and it will not, they won't, our bodies won't ask our permission. They'll just start protecting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If we continually associate bad sex with, or negative feelings, emotional or physical, with sexuality, then they'll start protecting ourselves.
I'll tell you, that is a truth and a very difficult thing to get around.
Mm-hmm.
especially when, I mean, I have progressive MS, so all of my symptoms are on 24/7, 365, 10 years now. Mm. And for me, we've adapted. This is normal. This is my new normal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the one very most difficult thing, is feeling like I can cuddle and be close and be comfortable at the same time, and not wanting my husband to feel like I'm rejecting him in any way, other than that my body doesn't want it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rebecca, I appreciate the call. You bring up some really good points about sexuality and chronic disease, and I think any sort of life-altering, diabetes, cancer, any of those things can have a significant effect on intimacy. And I do like that we're talking about intimacy more than sexuality, because I think they're very much a part of each other, but intimacy can be more important. And Rebecca, you talked about renegotiating sexuality when it comes with chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk just a second about that?
Well, I think it's kind of what Chris said about widening your repertoire, coming up with more than one way to connect, more than one way to be in your body, more than one way to be your erotic self. It often is necessary to keep things interesting. You know, I'm sure lots of people talk about novelty and sex as being very paired. And I think that that's part of that renegotiation. And I think it's very vulnerable. I mean, in order to do that, you have to talk about what you want, what your body feels like, what works, what doesn't, and to find a sexual language, which I think Chris talked about earlier. We don't send our kids out really very prepared to have these conversations. And so it's tricky.
Okay. Yeah, that was a great call. So I got an email here that says, why is sex so important to our health?
Oh, good question.
That's a big one. Do you guys have any information on, I assume we're talking about physical health?
Yeah, I think that, I don't have all the stats in front of me, but, you know, it's often cited as good for immunity to have climax. It's good for your body to have the sense of, you know, the circulation that occurs. I mean, from a purely physiological standpoint, and it's good to be in your body, you know. I think in our culture, we check out a little bit, kind of neck up, and spend our time, you know, hunched over a computer with our shoulders around our ears. I think that sex can be relaxing and a stress reliever. Chris?
Yeah, I think from a social perspective, we're social beings. And, you know, the example of a true hermit who goes off and lives by himself or herself in a cave is almost non-existent in the world. And we need other people. We exist in a social context. And for most of us, the ultimate expression of that is a naked sharing of our bodies with another person. I do want to mention that there are some people who would disagree with that. There are people in the world who are asexual. We sort of think of this as a sexual orientation, but they really, truly do not have that drive.
Yeah, it's interesting. You brought up statistics, some statistics from Newsweek that 15 to 20% of couples have sex no more than 10 times a year, which experts define as a sexless marriage. So no more than 10 times a year. And 20 to 30% of men and 30 to 50% of women say they have little or no sex drive. And that is that's probably a whole nother show that we could do on the differences, like where does that come from? And one of the things that we didn't get to today, and it's unbelievable that we're just about 6 or 7 minutes out, but is the sexual differences in men and women. And are there really sexual differences along gender lines, or is that just sort of, I don't know, old wives' tales that, you know, I read a quote that said, sometimes sex for men turns into intimacy, and sometimes intimacy for women turns into sex.
Mm-hmm. I think Chris
and
I...
Is that fair or is that unfair?
Well, this is a good way to get us having a dialogue because I think Chris and I have maybe differing opinions. I don't know. Certainly respectful differences of opinion.
Yep.
My practice is skewed. I see a lot of women and couples. I don't see a ton of individual men. So I would say in my experience, having worked in OBGYN and from my perspective, I think that we're learning a lot about sexual... response cycles of women looking really different from men. And I think it's one of the reasons why Viagra didn't turn out working for women. And it's one of the reasons why when they look at a medication for increasing drive in women, it's actually an SSRI or it didn't pan out either. But they look at actually changing the brain versus just blood flow. I think that women have... perhaps more of, they don't often report, we'll say, and I'm not going to get into statistics here, but a drive from their bodies that's frequent to engage in sexual activity. It's often, especially what I hear in long-term relationships, of a more intentional, sometimes intellectual decision of, hey, you know, I'm going to sort of invite myself into this. I'm going to invite my partner, and I think my body's going to get on board. And
that doesn't sound super hot.
Right, right. Yeah, my clients don't like that either. When I say, oh, just try this. But, Woo-hoo! You know, I think that women can sometimes report that's different around ovulation. You know, I think hormones have a role here.
Right.
Chris, what's your take?
Oh, I think there's differences between men and women in this area of sexuality. And some of them are biological, but I think most of them are cultural. When we ask men and women to write on a piece of paper, what about your sexuality is important? Why do you want to have sex? They write pretty much the identical kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Now, the expression of that, how that's expressed, and what a man has to do to negotiate that with a person, and what a woman has to do to negotiate that with a person, that, I think, is where a lot of gender influence comes up.
If men want to have, like, more sexual activity in their relationship, is it as simple, like, maybe should they vacuum more?
Do the dishes, yeah.
Do the dishes? My mom says vacuuming is the best foreplay.
Yeah, you know, I don't like the part of that that's so cliche. Or that's,
it is cliche.
Cause-effect.
I'm sorry.
That's,
yeah.
Do the dishes and I'll have sex with you. I don't like that economy, I think was the word I was
the
using
economy.
About that. But I think that there's something to it in the sense that if you, maybe either way, if you take the stress and the tasks off of your partner and show them that you care about them, as in a way of, I'd like to reserve your time later, you know, it's probably likely that sometimes that's going to lead to sex. I think.
Yeah, I was not suggesting a fee-for-service
right,
sort of setup,
right.
But I was suggesting that the more that you take your partner's needs and mm-hmm. their stresses yeah. into account and that you go out of your way to say, I know this will take a lot off your plate
right.
or I can contribute more so that you can rest or relax. I mean, I think
right.
that goes a long way towards intimacy and making people feel special.
Yeah. Sure. And that goes both ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
I see you.
Absolutely.
I see you clearly. I can see who you are and what you want, and I'm going to be helpful there. And that's sexy to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the things I really want to get to, and we're not going to, is in, maybe it's another show, but affairs, mm-hmm. abuse, maltreatment of a partner. So many people can't do the maintenance ahead of time or haven't, and they get into this position where they're mean to each other. I mean, I've heard some filthy stuff of mm-hmm. couples talking to each other in ways that nobody, they would never talk to anybody else, or they would be embarrassed if other people saw them talking that way. Mm. Can people recover from that kind of damage and that kind of ill will and get back to intimacy and closeness?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think it really depends on the couple. I think it depends on how long the patterns existed. I think I've definitely seen some pretty incredible resilience in couples. Once they really get to where is that coming from and why is it happening and how can they be more respectful to themselves and each other?
Yeah, I think that we all as individuals get to define, Ellen Cole, the original sex therapist in Alaska, mm-hmm. used to call them our walking issues. I think we all as individuals get to say where that line is. And when you get two people together who are very, very committed to the union. They can go through incredible amounts of pain together. But other people, their walking issues are, you know, their tolerance for pain in the union before they take a self-sufficient strategy or leaving is much less. And personally, I don't think it's the therapist's job to determine that for the person. That's mm-hmm. their job to determine it mm-hmm. before they come in.
The research would support that, you know, if you've read any of Gottman's work that talks about contempt, what is it for? Mm-hmm. Contempt and mm-hmm. defensiveness, stonewalling, that sort of thing, name-calling. The presence of those for a long period of time, you know, statistically, people tend to divorce. So, you know, he can. If you look in any of Gottman's research, you can look at, okay, things to avoid.
So people should apply to their relationships the stuff that they learned in kindergarten about sharing yeah. and playing yeah. nice and saying, using your nice words.
Right.
It's a good summary of the whole show.
You're right.
And your inside voice. I mean, it seems
not
like...
Not always.
Well, depending on whether it's we're talking about intimacy or sexuality.
Right, right.
All right. So anything... I mean, we are... This time goes so fast. I really do. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you guys came. But any... parting shots or closing thoughts for people to take home with them from this hour?
I think that there's never been people who in our culture are more savvy about sexuality. I mean, you look at any magazine, newspaper, the internet, whatever, there's all these articles on what to do. And I think that people tune it out a little bit. I think it's often not a complicated answer. It's more actually going back to what's recommended, you know, turning towards your partner, having eye contact, taking care of your own stuff. It's easy. It's kind of the commitment to it that I think is tricky.
Yeah, I think it's some of the show was focused on problems in sexuality, and I think it's human nature when we're experiencing a problem to look at the other person and say, if you were doing these three things differently, we wouldn't have a problem here. So mm-hmm. how about doing these three things differently? but, you know, for the most part, the people that I see are really warm and generous and connected and committed. And so there's a good reason why they're not doing those three things. Mm-hmm. So we have to ask ourselves, what am I doing that's perpetuating the problem?
Okay. My thanks to today's guests, Rebecca Love and Chris Reynolds. If you would like to continue today's conversation on Facebook, you can find the link on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We welcome any and all feedback and are especially interested in hearing your thoughts on subject of interest for the monthly mental health segment of Line One. I guess the thing I want to leave people with is that the best way to improve any relationship is to look honestly at your own role in the problem. If both people can turn their attention and focus to being a better friend and lover rather than blaming their partner, then real change can begin. As long as we are caught up in the injustice of how we are being treated or wronged, we cannot see the ways in which we are also doing the wronging. So take a look in the mirror. If you see a person without flaws, then blame away. If you, like most of us, see a flawed human being, then give your partner a break and get to work on healing yourself. Next week, Dr. Woodard and his guests will explore the Accountable Healthcare Act, and we will inform listeners about the insurance exchange enrollment period that starts October 1st. So why not tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, September 30th at 2 o'clock, repeating the same evening at 9 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA Anchorage. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Remember, treat each other well. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.